Women's Health Melbourne is an innovative, holistic fertility and women's health practice. We are world leaders in IVF and egg freezing and provide our patients with every opportunity to achieve their goals.
Our hand-picked, expert team provides the ultimate care experience for our patients. Reach us at womenshealthmelbourne.com.au and follow us at Women's Health Melbourne and at Dr. Rayleigh Alou. And welcome to Knocked Up, the podcast about fertility and women's health. You are joined as always by me, Geordie Morrison, and Dr. Rayleigh Alou, CREI Fertility Specialist. Welcome, Rayleigh.
Hi, Geordie. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Excited for today's topic. It's something new to me. Definitely not new to you, perhaps. We're talking about ovarian rejuvenation. It sounds amazing, Rayleigh. What is it?
It's a good name, isn't it?
It's a great name. Who doesn't want every part of them to be rejuvenated?
It's true. Look, ovarian rejuvenation is a term that is, I would say, more of a marketing term than a medical term for this process. The golden aim of IVF. We would love to be able to, in IVF, improve egg quality and egg number, particularly because an increasing number of modern women postpone pregnancy until later in life, where ovarian function is compromised and where low ovarian reserve and associated poor ovarian response in IVF is one of the major contributing factors to infertility and one of the main challenges in IVF for women who have a low ovarian reserve and for their doctors is that per treatment cycle of IVF, there are always going to be limited success rates and high rates of recurrent failure. And that's because every baby comes from one egg, but the more eggs we have in play, the higher chance we have in a poor prognosis patient of finding a good egg that makes a good embryo that can make a baby. So doctors are always looking for the holy grail of what can we do to make the ovary function better, particularly in women who are reaching the end of the reproductive line with their own eggs.
I was going to say, who is this for?
Yeah, so it's for women who are doing badly at IVF because they are unable to make eggs either at all or in high number. So with a low ovarian reserve at advanced maternal age. And that's really the study population that we've looked at for techniques of ovarian rejuvenation. And really what is meant by ovarian rejuvenation is injection of the ovary with autologous platelet-rich plasma, or PRP, and to see if that has an effect on infertility. So autologous means it's a product made from your own body, from your own blood, and platelet-rich plasma, or PRP, is a separation of plasma, which is the liquid part of blood, and that means derived from whole blood, so blood is drawn to make the sample. Yeah. And plasma is about 55% of blood. Platelets make up a much smaller percentage of blood. And what we want when we're trying to make PRP is we centrifuge, which is like spin in a special spinning machine, blood so that it separates into its different components. We remove the red blood cells, which is what makes blood red in color, and we produce plasma, which has a 5 to 10-fold higher concentration of growth factors. So PRP is a natural product that contains highly concentrated growth factors. And so what we do is we can take those growth factors and apply them to different circumstances. there's a lot of good evidence, and PRP is now widely used in another area of reproductive medicine, which is when we try and thicken the endometrium or the lining of the uterus using these growth factors. I use the analogy of fertilizer on the lawn. We put the growth factors on the endometrium inside the uterus to try and improve the thickness of the lining for an embryo to implant. And that is now really, I would say, a non-controversial and non-experimental therapy to try and help women with a thin lining, which is another reason why sometimes people find it hard to get pregnant with IVF or naturally. But the use of PRP by injecting it into the ovary is a much more novel therapy. It's much newer. It's not as well studied, and I would still consider it to be experimental, but it can be offered to women with informed consent, acknowledging that it is still an unproven therapy.
What are the risks involved with PRP for ovarian rejuvenation?
This depends on how the PRP is injected into the ovary. And one problem that we see surgically when women have a very, very low egg count is that their ovaries are very, very small and can be hard to see on ultrasound. One way of giving PRP is before women having IVF to inject some PRP into the ovary following an egg collection. So you can actually do it at an egg collection where you collect eggs that haven't had exposure and inject the PRP at the same time. So that is an option. But for women who are having PRP outside of that context where their ovaries are very, very small and unstimulated, usually it's done laparoscopically, which is a surgical procedure. So it is quite an invasive procedure. You come into hospital, you have a general anesthetic. We put a little camera through the umbilicus, which is the belly button, and have a look. And we introduce other instruments through port sites in the abdomen to be able to inject the PRP using a special needle into each ovary. This carries the risk of the operation. It also carries a risk of infection, both from the preparation of the PRP and the injection into the ovary, but that risk remains very small. There's not really a risk of allergy because we're using your own blood to make the PRP. There is a risk of discomfort. You might have pain after the procedure for a limited amount of time. There's a risk of failure that even though we're injecting the PRP to try and get your ovaries to behave better, they may not definitely behave any better having had the PRP. In terms of side effects, there haven't really been any reported side effects from having PRP injected into the ovary, and that makes sense because we're not introducing anything foreign.
The side effects more relate to the procedure itself that you've had general
anesthetic. Yeah, exactly. Drugs you might have had to put you to sleep, those kind of things. And in terms of long-term risks, well, because it's a very novel procedure, we don't really know if there are any long-term risks. And that is, a risk in itself of introducing a new therapy, that because it is a new therapy, we don't have long-term follow-up data as to whether there could be any other risks associated with injecting PRP into the ovary. But based on first principles, one would think it's a pretty safe thing to do.
Okay. And like you mentioned that it's a novel procedure. So what evidence do we have that it works?
Well, that is a very, very good question to ask, because when we look at evidence, we rank evidence in medicine and we look at the quality of evidence. And the most highly rated form of evidence is a meta-analysis of randomized control studies, where you have one group of patients who is matched having a treatment and another group of patients who have the same characteristics as the first group of patients having a placebo, randomizing those people to one group or another and then following up in high numbers to see if an effect is real. those kind of studies have not been done for this treatment. And so we're really relying on lower quality forms of evidence. We're looking at studies that have been done that are either case control or cohort studies and retrospective studies, like a case series type of studies. So this was first looked at in Greece. It has been looked at all over the world in different groups, but really in individual doctors following up their patients more so than randomized control studies. And because the group of women that we're looking at in terms of who might benefit from PRP is really that end of the line group of women who have very low ovarian reserve at advanced age and who have poor response, the degree of difference, if it does help, may be quite subtle. And so it is actually very hard to design and fund these kind of really big studies that would be really helpful for us. We're really working with PRP off observational data and off the first principles, potential effects of growth factors. And from that observational data, we have seen some good initial evidence showing that women who have had ovarian PRP have been shown to ovulate more functionally after having the PRP and have responded potentially better in IVF in terms of ovarian response. There is no data that I'm aware of that has proven an improved live birth rate for this patient group using PRP. So I think it is very important to document informed consent for this technology. It is a very experimental technology still. The way I tend to raise it with my patients is if they ask me, is there something else we can do when we're really at the end of the line for their ovarian response, rather than suggesting it as a routine therapy, because in my opinion, it's not a routine therapy. It is still an experimental therapy.
And how do we know that a patient isn't experiencing the placebo effect?
That's a really, really good question. Because sometimes when we have a therapy and we observe an effect, we don't really know if the effect is because of the therapy or if the effect is of a random nature. And when it comes to the ovary, there can be month-to-month variation in how a person responds, even at the lower end of the ovarian reserve spectrum. There's also evidence that sometimes when we have an intervention, even if the intervention is positive in nature, it may not be for the reasons that we think it is. So the postulated effects of PRP are really secondary to the growth factors that we're injecting. And there's all of these growth factors in PRP. There's insulin-like growth factors 1 and 2. There's fibroblast growth factor, epidermal growth factor, transforming growth factor beta. There are hormones, there are cytokines, there are other platelet-derived substances like fibronectin and vitronectin. There's all of these molecules that are involved and initiate wound healing. That's one of the jobs of platelets. And in terms of the growth factors initiating changes, we make the assumption that when we introduce the PRP, that it's by those processes, by those cellular remodeling processes and matrix synthesis processes and angiogenesis processes for forming new blood vessels, re-epithelialization. Those are the processes that the platelets are derived to enact. But we don't know for sure that that's how it works, if it works. It could be for another reason. It might be that it's because we're simply mechanically disrupting the ovary. It could be that if there is a real effect, that it's temporary. We don't know for sure. Even though we've seen serial investigators around the world, lots of different studies that have reported improved responses to ovulation induction and stimulation in IVF after treatment with PRP, you know, previously published reports are small case series still. And whether the PRP actually improves ovarian performance is still unproven. However, in terms of this, it is, you know, still widely offered. And that is because doctors and patients are both seeking ways to try and go that extra mile to do everything possible to help someone at poor prognosis of success have a baby.
And so you've mentioned a baby. I would say that's obviously the result we expect. Is there anything else that someone should expect that they might know sooner? Would it be a higher egg count at their next egg collection or a higher fertilization rate? What would we expect to see if we've successfully had ovarian rejuvenation?
Well, a very important point is that I would never expect an instantaneous result from ovarian rejuvenation, because theoretically it takes about 100 days for a follicle to go from resting pool in the ovary to being at the point that it can be stimulated in an IVF cycle. So one important point with ovarian rejuvenation is I would expect a lag if there is an effect, mm-hmm. and that might happen about 2-3 months after the initial injection. We don't know how long an effect will last. What has been shown in studies with good documentation is that FSH levels, brain follicle stimulating hormone levels, which can be elevated at the beginning of a menstrual cycle for women who have a very low ovarian reserve, have been shown to be less in women after ovarian PRP. And in those case studies, there have been pregnancies and there have been women who have had further egg collections with more eggs collected. However, it's not a radical effect, and so we do not know for sure that this is not just because of cycle-to-cycle variation, and we don't know that it's definitely because of the PRP. So we're really working on first principles with an absence of good quality evidence at this time for PRP. Having said that, because this treatment is novel, these studies do take time and they are underway. So it's quite often in reproductive medicine that new technologies start off as very experimental. Some of them will end up to be orthodox and incorporated into what we consider, you know, really bread and butter parts of the treatment that we give patients over time as more evidence is gathered and as effects are proven. The opposite can also be true. So sometimes we see technologies that are really promising and have, you know, good theoretical basis as to why we might hypothesize that they might work. But then we study them and some of them are discounted, and we see that sometimes we try things and we study them and initial evidence might be supportive, but then over time as we have more patients treated and we have more high quality studies that scrutinize confounding factors, some technologies are then discounted and thought not to be worthwhile. So I would very much in summary say that ovarian PRP may be something that we can do when we've run out of other options and we want to try something different. It has promise. I would never say that it will definitely work, and it's something that you can discuss with a patient and consider in their individual circumstances. It is a very invasive thing to do, and it would obviously carry expense as well, because coming into hospital and having a procedure does cost. So it's something that we can discuss in context of the evidence, the procedure itself, and its place in an individual person's therapy. I would say also that it's something that I would never have personally done a few years ago, and it's something that I have been doing more recently. And the reason for that is that there have been more studies and more evidence presented, and it's gone from something being very fringe to something that is, while unproven, now something that has been widely offered in many centres. And we're all trying to do our best to try and help people have a baby with their own egg, because, you know, there are lots of different options in IVF, and there are past episodes, Geordie, of this podcast looking into egg donation. And egg donation is a wonderful way to have a baby if you can't have a baby with your own egg. But it is the dearest wish of many women to have a baby with their own egg. And my feeling is that I'm happy to support women in things that they want to try with informed consent, even if they are at the edge of what is considered proven, as long as there is a good intellectual hypothesis and reason as to why something might be of assistance, and that there is a growing field of evidence supporting its use.
Yeah, I think, like we've said, is this is a new idea, but so was egg freezing not so long ago, and we've seen the success that that can have. And it's exciting to know there are other opportunities for your patients.
Well, that's a really good example of a technology that until 2012 was considered experimental, and now it's considered mainstream. And that's just the evolution of fertility medicine. And we're very lucky, and I feel very blessed, to work in a field where we're constantly challenged with new ideas and always trying to make things better.
Thank you, Raelia. Really interesting topic today.
To support Knocked Up, leave us a review or recommend to a friend. Join us on Instagram at Knocked Up Podcast, and join Raelia at Dr. Raelia Lu. And email us your questions to podcast@womenshealthmelbourne.com.au.